Chapter 27. Trembling Resolve. The Allied attacks which, it was anticipated, would bring the Germans to their knees in 1917, were to be threefold. First, the attack of the Russians. Once the Tsar had fallen, Brusilov had valiantly delivered his knockout blow. But the attack had shattered against the enemy. The Italian attack hadn't come to much in the course of the spring. Prime Minister Rosselli, who in the world still remembers that name, was a decrepit old man, a spark barely alive. In the Parliament, the socialists were rebellious. "It's not tolerable for the Italian people to have to face another winter of war," they declared, already feeling cold months before Christmas. As in the preceding year, it was the Anglo-French front which would have to deliver and, if necessary, receive the big blow. The new commander-in-chief, Nivelle, didn't intend to be satisfied with pecking away at the front. He wanted a breakthrough battle. Liaudi, Petain, and even Painlev, the Minister of War, put scarcely any credence in an attack. Nivelle played the prima donna, "We shall break through the German front whenever we wish to." The tactics he envisioned were to attack a weak point by surprise. In one day, he asserted, or at most 2 days, the German front would be broken, and, with the breach thus opened, the terrain will be clear for us to go where we will, to the coast of the North Sea or to the Belgian capital, to the Meuse or to the Rhine. Nivelle was opposed by Marshal von Hindenburg, the powerful and unshakable German military commander. He was seconded by General Ludendorff, the true military genius of the First World War. They were not about to give the French either a weak point or a chance of surprise. They knew that strategy must not stifle tactics. They had suspected the plan of their adversaries, which in any case had been announced with great fanfare by the newspapers. Hindenburg and Ludendorff, silently and with the greatest of care, had prepared huge, impregnable concrete positions 20 kilometers back. Just before the French offensive, they fell back to these lines with great stealth. The terrain in front of the Germans was now desolate, virtually impassable, and flooded over a wide area. The best officers of the French general staff were worried. The offensive was being lured into a trap. Nivelle, however, was cockier than ever. "If I'd been giving Hindenburg his orders, I'd want him to pull back just as he's done." Now that the Germans had made things so easy for him, he launched the attack on April 9, 1917. The Anglo-Canadians went over the top first, then the French. The attack extended from the Oise to La Montagne de Reims. The most famous battle position would be Chemin des Dames. Years later I passed through that ghastly landscape. Human skulls still lay around all over. Tourists used to carry them away in the luggage racks of their bicycles. 40,000 men were killed in the first few dozen hours. Nivelle thought he could carry the day by hurling tanks into the battle, makeshift tanks in which the gasoline storage was placed forward. In one afternoon, 60 of the 120 tanks burst into flames. The crews were burned alive. After 3 days, the Allies had to break off the battle without having overrun even a single one of Hindenburg's bunkers. The returning soldiers were in terrible condition. An officer who witnessed their return from the front wrote, "I have never seen anything more poignant than the two regiments streaming along that road in front of me all day long. First there were skeletons of companies, sometimes led by a surviving officer supporting himself with a cane. All of them were marching, or rather advancing with short steps, knees giving way, and zigzagging as though intoxicated. Then came some groups that were perhaps squads, perhaps sections, you couldn't tell. They went along, heads down, despondent, weighed down by their gear, carrying their blood and dirt-soiled rifles by the slings. The color of their faces scarcely differed from the color of their uniforms. Mud had covered everything, dried completely, and then been soiled afresh with more mud. Their clothing as well as their skin was encrusted with it. Several cars came driving up with a roar, scattering this pitiable flood of survivors of the great hecatomb. But they said nothing. They had lost even the strength to complain. An unfathomable sorrow welled in the eyes of these veritable war slaves, and they came in sight of the village rooftops. In that movement their features appeared taut with suffering and congealed with dust. Those silent faces seemed to proclaim something awful, the unthinkable horror of their martyrdom. Some territorials who were watching beside me remained pensive. Two of those territorials silently cried like women. Thus ended, in April 1917, General Nivelle's race to Ostend and the Rhine. The British Marshal Haig had thought he would do better than his French colleague. He launched his attack between Cambrai and a Flemish village with a complicated name, Passchendaele. He was assisted by Belgian troops and by a French contingent. Marshal Haig, too, thought to carry the day with a massive assault by his tanks. They penetrated the first German line of defense just in time to be turned into an enormous inferno. There, too, half the tanks were hit squarely in the fuel storage section and destroyed amid the screams of crews being roasted alive in their flaming coffins. Afterwards it was the usual butchery. Passchendaele was one of the biggest slaughterhouses of the war. The number of English, Scottish and Irish who were killed or wounded there is well nigh incredible, 400,000, for nothing, the historian Farrow adds. None of which would keep Joffre, the French general, from writing with reference to his British friends, "I should never dare leave them to guard the lines, alone, they would be routed." Or Pétain from adding, in 1917, the year of Passchendaele, "the British command is incompetent." As may be seen, among the Allies brotherhood reigned. The news from Italy did not gladden the Allies. In the Lizenzo Valley, amid rock walls 1,000 meters high, the Germans and Austrians during those months were in top form. They had finished off the Russians. They occupied all of Serbia and Romania as well. For the first time, Hindenburg and Ludendorff had agreed to second the efforts of the Austrians by giving them 37 German divisions. Certain moves of the new Austro-Hungarian Emperor, Charles I, disturbed them, and by reinforcing him they hoped to restore his enthusiasm. 7 German divisions would serve as the battering ram of the attack. 2 traitors had communicated the Austro-German offensive plans to the Italian General Carmona several days in advance. Despite the fact that he had 41 divisions at his disposal, General Carmona was worried about symptoms of a growing spirit of revolution among the troops. It was already October 14, and snow was falling. In 3 days, the principal peaks had fallen to the Germans. From then on the valley was open. The disaster of Caporetto was underway. Some Italian units heroically sacrificed themselves, but others surrendered in entire divisions. Countless deserters turned tail and fled. The Tagliamento was crossed. The Italian army couldn't pull itself together until it reached the Piave. The results were added up, not too many had been killed, about 10,000. But the number of Italian prisoners taken was immense, 293,000. Moreover, 3,000 cannon, half of the entire Italian artillery forces had been lost, and more than 300,000 rifles, 73,000 horses and mules, and the principal food and supply depots. Caporetto meant the complete loss of morale in Italy. The phenomenon was not limited to the Italians. Armies everywhere were grumbling. The soldiers had suffered too much. They had seen too many massacres. In Russia they had set off an explosion, but it was plain that in France, too, there was danger that mutinies would break out and the front give way. In August 1914 the deluded people had embarked enthusiastically on a short war that would be not so much hard work as a romp. At worst, the French and the Russians would meet on the banks of the Spree at Berlin within 3 months. As may be seen in photos of the period, in Berlin, Vienna, London, and Paris a popular delirium held sway. At Munich a young fellow named Adolf Hitler fell on his knees to thank the heavens for that stroke of good luck. The thousands of trains and the first columns of trucks bore destination points chalked on them in big letters, Berlin for the French, Paris for the Germans. It was going to be a fine trip. But it had finally gone off the tracks. The common people knew nothing at all, neither how horrible war is, and it had reached new heights in the West during the past half century, nor how Freemasonry had directed their members in high office to use all possible subterfuges, lies and diplomatic forgeries to pursue interests alien and detrimental to them, the majority of common people. The Sazonovs, the Balfours, the Poincarés, with cynicism and hypocrisy, were leading the people to genocide. There had been the great massacres of 1914, then those of 1915, then those of 1916. Now it had started all over again, for the fourth time, in 1917. More than half the conscripts of 1914 were dead. Whatever their country, men wanted no more of it. There was great misery on the home front as well. The women were exhausted by the difficult job of cultivating the fields in the absence of the men, substituting their feeble strength for the hundreds of thousands of requisitioned horses, and with turning out the millions of artillery shells in the war factories alongside alien laborers from the colonies. People were cold and hungry. In the beginning, the masses had been in complete agreement, because in those days the patriotism of the people was a thousand times more active than it is at present. The working man was a nationalist. The average middle-class person got a lump in his throat when a military band passed by. The socialist deputies, too, had voted for war, the French as well as the German. The ballyhoo in the press had roused the people. Anyone who had protested against the war in 1914 would have been lynched. That was no longer the case in 1917. The slaughters of 1917 brought the soldiers to the end of their morale. Many French units rebelled. In each of 60 French battalions or regiments, several hundred men on separate occasions flatly refused to return to combat. At Soissons, two regiments which had mutinied attempted to march on Paris. The Internationale was sung and red flags were waved. It was St. Petersburg in miniature. It wasn't a general revolt, but there were more than 40,000 mutineers nonetheless, who for several days made it almost impossible to maintain order. The military leaders had to resort to reprisals. There were thousands of arrests, 3,427 men were sentenced, 544 of them condemned to death. Most horrible of all, soldiers had to shoot their comrades. There were 116 executions. Without thousands of imprisonments, the war in the West would have been irretrievably lost by the Allies, just as in Russia, and France would have been engulfed in revolution. It was the same everywhere. By hurling their countries into a war of conquest or of reconquest, in 1914, Alsace-Lorraine on the one side, the Balkans and Constantinople on the other, the warmongers had destroyed the foundations of Europe. Her economic basis was shattered. Her peoples were decimated. International order had been struck a direct blow. Only the firm grip of certain statesmen, who had no use for democratic whims, here and there stemmed the catastrophe. Thus Clemenceau, who came to power on November 14, 1917, hatchet in hand, quelled dissent ruthlessly. "I'll burn everything, even the furniture," the fearless old man of 76 years declared. "Neither treason nor half-treason, just war. Nothing but war." The so-called war for freedom could not be won except by muzzling freedom. The radical Clemenceau, forcing the panic-stricken parliament to turn to him, became the absolute master of France in 1917. He immediately crushed all anti-war opposition, imprisoned his defeatist adversaries, shot those who were traitors or who looked like traitors to him. Even Poincaré, the Masonic provocateur of 1914, who had had no choice but to go along with Clemenceau's nomination, had been shut up in the gilded cage of the presidential palace after having had a muzzle clapped over his mouth. In the beginning, the Socialist Party, a third of the German deputies, had acted patriotically. Then its extremists had organized strikes in the war factories, turning thousands of workers away from their jobs. The strikes had seriously impeded production. As for the army, the most disciplined army in the world, it remained and would remain brave and orderly right up to the last day of the war. But the German political arm would not have its Clemenceau. Wilhelm II kept far away from his troops. He was neither a strategist nor a tactician. He was enthusiastic when his troops were moving ahead, dismayed at every defeat. "Pray for us," he telegraphed at the moment of the Marne to his worthy empress, who was busy with her knitting. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg totally lacked the psychology of a fighting man. He had been replaced by a completely unknown functionary. Michaelis, who had formerly been in charge of the replenishment of stores in Prussia. A third chancellor had succeeded him, a man named Hertling, a Bavarian member of the Society of Resolute Christians, and an aged bibliophile. Power, to him, instead of being a marvelous instrument of direct, complete, and decisive action, was a bitter chalice. He didn't drink it for very long. Arteriosclerosis deprived him of his cup. He went from one fainting fit to another. At last he received extreme unction, in a cloud of incense. Things were worse still in Austria-Hungary, where four successive chancellors, Berchtold, Martinitz, Seidler, and Esterhazy, succeeded each other in the space of a year. Germany's great misfortune was this: if the French had had a Hertling, a resolute Christian floating in incense, as council president, or if they had simply kept their Vivianis, Ribots, and Painlevs, hesitant, shaky, tired old democratic nags, or if, on the contrary, the Germans had possessed a political leader like Clemenceau, cleaver in hand, the fate of the world would have been different. Clemenceau had been called the father of victory, and he deserved it. Without him, despite the immense sacrifices of the French soldiers, there would have been no victory for France. She would have gone down, if at the height of military disaster, she'd had no one to lead her but a bearded little hypocrite like Poincaré, Europe's most efficient gravedigger. Since 1914, France had been beaten every year. One more hemorrhage like Verdun, and France will fall in a faint, the newspaper Lure had seen fit to write. Out of the 3,600,000 men of 1914, there remained only 964,000 surviving combatants at the end of 1917, 2,636,000 were dead, wounded, prisoners, or missing. More than 10 of the wealthiest departments of France had been occupied for nearly 3 years. War profiteers were arrogantly living the high life. Financially, France had been bled white. It had been necessary to issue 60 billion francs in bonds for the national defense. As far as loans went, some had been covered only to the amount of 47.5%. Small investors, their heads turned by the hired press, had laid out billions in the Russian loans before 1914, and now found themselves ruined. As for agriculture, it had declined 30-50%, 52% of the French soldiers were peasants. Prices had already gone up 400% and would reach 600% by the end of the war. The bread was vile, but censorship prohibited anyone from writing that the mixture of corn and wheat flours can cause alopecia. Syphilis was ravaging the country, but there, too, the censors were vigorously plying their scissors. The information blackout, ordered by narrow-minded and despotic military men, was unbelievable. Prefects could send reports to their ministers only after they had been submitted for censorship. The ignorance in which the civilian members of the government were left was such that the president of the council once learned only from his florist that the army general headquarters was moving from Chantilly. It was imperative that the public be completely ignorant of anything that might awaken its suspicions, such as, for example, the news that serious mutinies had taken place or that 2 million Hindus and blacks were being used on the battlefields. Or that anti-colonial troubles had taken place in Senegal, Dahomey, and Annam, following protests against the deportation of native workers and soldiers to Europe. Or that without the labor of women, there would be a shortage of artillery shells at the front. It was only in a small informal meeting that Joffre had seen fit to state that if the women working in the factories were to stop for 20 minutes, France would lose the war. On the other hand, the press abounded in marvelous pronouncements aimed at stirring the masses. General Fayol, Joan of Arc is looking down on us from heaven with satisfaction. La Croix, the history of France is the history of God. Lavedon, member of the Academy, I believe by the power of all that is holy in this crusade for civilization. I believe in the blood of the wounds, in the water of benediction. I believe in us. I believe in God. I believe. I believe. If Lavedon still believed in that wonderful jumble, soldiers believed less and less in the blood of the wounds, and the public had more and more doubts about the regenerative effects of the water of benediction. Far from benediction, what France was experiencing in 1917 was hunger, hundreds of thousands of widows and orphans, and millions of soldiers ground up in the mill of trench warfare. British censorship was no less fanatical and idiotic. On its orders, the press asked that the works of Wagner, Mozart, and Richard Strauss be outlawed. Leon Daudet in Paris titled an article, "Down with Wagner." Derrida and Cranach narrowly escaped being taken down from the walls of the Louvre and the British Museum. Now, after 3 years of war, in France as well as in Germany, socialist and syndicalist leaders, who were only a handful in 1914 but were many in 1917, spoke against these prohibitions and tried, despite a thousand complications arranged by the police, to rescue public opinion from this appalling state of affairs. Some of them were undoubtedly ringleaders ready to serve any cause, with an eye to making a row, and often hired for that purpose. For example, the communist agitators of Berlin. In 1915, after two previous meetings in Bern, a pacifist conference had been held at Zimmerwald in Switzerland. It brought together a total of 38 delegates, but an attempt at communist infiltration had been evident. Lenin, Trotsky, Radek, and Zinoviev were there, teeth bared like Siberian wolves. The following year, the son-in-law of Karl Marx, Longuet, and his followers held a pacifist demonstration at the French Socialist Congress of April 16, 1916, which attracted much attention. Their motion demanding a peace with no annexations obtained a third of the ballots, 900 votes against 1800. Another conference was held at Kienthal. Its manifesto already had the tone of the October 1917 harangues at St. Petersburg. Proletarians of Europe. Millions of cadavers cover the battlefields. Millions of men will be disabled for the rest of their days. Europe has become a giant human slaughterhouse. Above and beyond the borders, above and beyond the fields of battle, above and beyond the devastated countryside, proletarians of all countries, unite. At Kienthal, Lenin's proposal to turn the War of Nations into civil war triumphed, receiving two-thirds of the votes. On February 18, 1917, the committee set forth its plan of battle to the proletariat, to turn their weapons not against their brothers, the foreign soldiers, but against imperialism, the enemy at home. One astonishing note, a million copies of that anti-militarist manifesto were distributed in Germany. In France, on the other hand, only 10,000 copies could be distributed in secret. In Paris, anyone who was not for the war was a traitor, so much so that the syndicalist leaders were all given a special physical examination by a review board. None of them, however bow-legged, escaped induction. The chief of the Second Bureau, Colonel Galbit, saw to it that special treatment was reserved for them, ordering them to certain Saharan regions where the rolling of roads coincides with the shaping of character, and from which one does not always return. The wish was expressed clearly and elegantly. Pacifist propaganda during the First World War was above all the work of the left and especially of the extreme left. The industrialists, the financiers, and the middle classes should have been more concerned than anyone about the senseless destruction of wealth as well as the massive elimination of the cream of the labor force, the youth. The conservatives, on the contrary, during those 4 years lived in a hermetically sealed world of claptrap and illusions. It was the intellectuals, from Barres to Paul Bourget and Henri Massès, who most eloquently praised the extraordinary benefits of the war and most execrated the savagery of Kant, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and the other German barbarians. Alone in this tumult of hate, Romain Rolland published his Odysseus de la Mêlée, Above the Battle, which for all its title was nothing but a long lyrical sigh in favor of peace. The men of the left, French or foreign, were not necessarily agents of Moscow and enemies of society. Often they were simply friends of mankind. One of the latter was Camille Huysmans, Secretary General of the Second International, a Belgian with the long-ringed neck of a restless boa. He was intelligent, caustic, cynical for its shock value, and profoundly tolerant. In 1917, Camille, he was called that in Antwerp, had urged pacifism along rational and strictly logical lines. The previous conferences in Switzerland had been too impassioned, and above all too much controlled by Lenin and the other Bolshevik theoreticians, for whom the world was an object to be manipulated cold-bloodedly. A serious conference was needed in which the adversaries would meet again to deal in depth, without prejudice and without intemperate language, with the possibility and the conditions for a peace of reconciliation. As Secretary General of a Second International stricken with paralysis, Huysmans dreamed of restoring to the International the use of its limbs. It was in that spirit that in 1917 he convoked what has been called the Stockholm Conference. There the direct representatives of the enemy peoples were to get to know each other, exchange views, and weigh the chances of a peace without annexations or indemnities. Was such a peace possible? Would it be possible to end a war in which all had been partly responsible, in which neither side, despite several million dead, had achieved decisive results or seemed in a position to do so? The matter was worth discussing. It was not discussed, however, and for a good reason. Those principally concerned, the French delegates, had been forbidden to attend the conference, the Paris government having refused to grant them the passports that would have enabled them to make the trip. The French government did not want anyone talking peace in any way, shape, or form. To talk of peace would be to make concessions, to admit to a few faults, to renounce certain claims. One could imagine that in similar negotiations the enemy, especially the Germans, who had been the big winner up to that point, would not grant everything, acknowledge everything, deliver everything. But was it really unreasonable to be reasonable? In 1917, there were already 17 million men dead, wounded, or taken prisoner. Trying to save the lives, blood, and freedom of millions more who would be lost if the war continued, was that really so criminal? Wasn't all that blood worth a few sacrifices, a few blows to one's ego? Many delegates came to Stockholm, but the most important, the French, were not there, kept at home by their police, who would thenceforth consider them dangerous suspects. Even a man like Camille Huysmans, who was not French, became the object of a relentless persecution by the French police after the Stockholm Conference. They whipped up campaigns to discredit him everywhere. He was the man of Stockholm, paid, of course, by the Germans. The newspapers repeated it over and over without let-up. He was so defamed that after the Allied victory in 1918 his own followers, who were ashamed of their leader, barred him in Brussels from access to the Maison du Peuple. For 10 years he suffered a persecution that was comparable to the ordeal, in France, of M. Queloz. Even before 1914 Queloz had understood that the French and the Germans were interdependent, and that it was necessary to effect a reconciliation with the Germans instead of fighting them. For his effrontery, he was repudiated for several years. Camille Huysmans had to expiate his bid for peace for a longer period, 10 years. It was then that King Albert I, the Roy Chevalier of the Allies, summoned Huysmans to his palace at Brussels. Up to that time the Belgian monarch had refrained from speaking. The passions and the hatreds were such that to say anything slightly favorable to the man of Stockholm would have been to commit suicide. In 1917, before going to the Stockholm Conference, the so-called agent of the Kaiser had visited King Albert in person on the Flanders front, where he commanded the Belgian troops facing the Germans. Huysmans wanted to be sure that the Congress he was organizing at Stockholm did not constitute either a challenge or an obstacle to the military and political plans of the man who occupied the very first place, morally, on the Allied side. The others, Poincaré, Gray, Sonnino, Brascianu, had been double or triple dealers. Albert I, on the other hand, was the victim of his country's geography, which made it a railroad turntable through which all trains claimed the right of passage. His own conduct had been noble and proper. He listened carefully to Camille Huysmans. His straightforward answer was, word for word, as follows, "You are right. It is necessary to negotiate. No second war, whatever my government may think of it. Carry on your efforts. I will protect you." I could have told the truth, Huysmans wrote to Delaunay, the Belgian historian, but I held stubbornly to what the king himself said, and that's the way it was. It was handled rather solemnly. The king later cleared Camille Huysmans, who later became prime minister, in the presence of two Belgian generals, whom he had summoned and charged in my presence to tell the truth, Huysmans himself related on coming out of the royal palace. But that honest man paid for his efforts, which, however ill-considered in view of the passions of the time, were humane and correct in any event, with 10 years of being slandered. To destroy my effectiveness, Huysmans stated, the French Secret Service tried to represent me as a man in the pay of Germany. In Belgium that accusation was believed in the French-speaking part of the country, and also in Brussels. There were also certain semi-official negotiations, involving Austria-Hungary and Germany, which might have made it possible as early as 1917 to re-establish peace. How and why did they fail?